Radio.
The Joys and Struggles of Family Life, a presentation by Christian Stevens from the Finding Your Calcutta 2016 retreat, organized by St. Rafka Youth.
Thanks, everyone. Can anyone recognize any of the figures up here, any of the photos? Up here? Very good. She looks like a mother, doesn't she, when she grows up?
Is that Gianna Waller?
Where? There? No. There? Yep, that's St. Gianna. And one of her elder kids trying to do an old-fashioned eye poke into the baby. You can see the look on her face. It's like, you know, don't poke the baby's eyes. Any others?
That does look like Pope Francis at the bottom
left. Yeah, that is
good. Good pick. Well done. Well done. When I first asked that question, someone said, he looks so familiar, but I just don't know who he is, but he looks familiar. What about this one? No, no.
Benedict?
Very good. Yeah, yeah. Little Joseph Ratzinger. This one is probably not fair because it's hard to get. That's a little baby Pierre Frassati, Giorgio Frassati. With his old man, yeah, with the mad mo. And that leaves this one here. Any ideas? You should have said either style. Very good, very good. The reason I wanted to put these photos up as on the opening page is to get us to think of these people as members of a family. Okay, so to realize that someone went to school with Pope Francis, that someone right now is walking around saying, yeah, me and him used to hang out, you know. Or you had St. Teresa's parents wondering, you know, what she was going to do when she was older and, you know, couldn't even imagine that she would end up being a saint of the caliber that she is. So this sense that everyone is introduced into the world as a member of a family, okay. What I wanted to do was pick out some quotes to, I guess, give us something of a theological background to a lot of the day-to-day nitty-gritty which we saw in the clip and which no doubt all of us are going through. And as a basis for each topic, I'm going to put up a quote from Pope Francis's new exhortation. Just out of curiosity, has anyone read it? Okay. I encourage you to work through it. It's big. This isn't the kind of thing you think I'm going to sit down and just knock off Pope Francis's new exhortation. It's a lot of reading, but it's written for everyone to understand it. Okay. In a sense, I think that's part of where, on a side note, I think Pope Francis, because he wants to write in a way that reaches out to everybody, he risks being misunderstood by those of us who are like, why did you use this word? You know, why couldn't? And so in a sense, he takes the risk to reach out to everybody. So please give it a go reading it. I think you'll get something from it. The first point that I want us to be aware of, and it's something which Pope Francis starts with as well, is that the entire history of creation and salvation is about families. It's really the heart of where it all takes place, that nothing can enter into the human story without going via the family, that there are no human problems that are not family problems. There are no human success stories which are not family success stories. These two things are completely inseparable. Okay? So he says here, the Bible is full of families, births, love stories, and family crises. This is true from its very first page with the appearance of Adam and Eve's family, with all its burden of violence, but also enduring strength to its very last page, where we behold the wedding feast of the Lamb. Jesus' description of the two houses, one built on rock and the other on sand, symbolizes any number of family situations shaped by the exercise of their members' freedom. So creation story is basically about the beginning of families, okay? One of which is the human family. And it starts off with very simple beginnings, and Adam and Eve are given a very simple charge, you might say, to be fruitful and multiply. And in that single principle, you might say we can unfold the whole natural law, you know. So after sin enters the picture and we've got all kinds of evil taking place, we've got sibling murder taking place, God kind of reminds people, you know, being fruitful and multiplying does not involve killing people. But it was all there in the beginning, in a sense of a principle to unpack in our lives. Once sin enters the picture, we see that we have husband and wife hiding from each other out of fear. The possibility, for example, of people getting too close to someone else and feeling too vulnerable in their presence. The relationship between the sexes lends itself to irrational desires and domination. So after the first sin, God is basically speaking to them individually. I'm sure you all know the section where God is saying, you know, now that you've done this, such and such. And often people think that this is God basically making up punishments for Adam and Eve now that you've done this. You know, because you've done this, childbearing will be hard. Or because you've done this, your desire will be for your husband. As if God kind of thinks of punishments to get people with. Rather, what he's doing is unpacking the very nature of sin itself. Okay? So when God says, you will desire your husband and he will lord it over you, the problem is not desiring her husband. That's always present. What he's talking about is a disordered desire. You know, you might say that here is the shadows of everyone who wants to be with the wrong person, who wants to be with people who treat them badly. And on the flip side, saying that he will lord it over you, we see, in a sense, almost a kind of prophetic vision of a lot of the sexism which would follow through history. There is sibling rivalry to the point of murder, and there is the refusal to take responsibility for one's family. Out of the envy between Cain, the envy Cain has for Abel because of his sacrifice to God, and God says to Cain, it's a very interesting dialogue which they have. Basically, he says to Cain, look, if you've done your best, what are you upset about? Why are you envious? You know, and he gives him a warning that sin is creeping at the door. It's not too late. Do something about it. Okay. Cain kills Abel, and then God asks Cain, where is your brother? And it's an interesting thing because you know, we might try and think to ourselves, well, how does God speak to them at this point? You know, does it sound like a voice coming from the clouds? But if you think about it, God asking these questions is still what he does today in our consciences. You know, when he spurs in people's minds questions like, where is your son? Where is your father? You know, and we have to respond to that. We have to kind of answer his question. No one will ever know apart from us and God what our answer was, but we have to answer it. And Cain famously says, am I my brother's keeper? You know, basically the first appeal to autonomy to justify sin. basically, he's a big boy. He can look after himself, you know. I don't want to impose myself on Abel and whatnot. All the kinds of excuses we hear even these days to justify neglect of people is right there at the beginning. God's comfort, though, to them is very mysterious, but he basically promises that a child of theirs will defeat this enemy. Now, it's interesting to note the way God could have worded this is unlimited. He could have used any other phrases, but he particularly wants to refer to Jesus, as we know looking back on the Messiah, as their child. Now, what's the significance of this? Is that this is a member of their family. In other words, what's the point here? The point here is about a family being reunited, a family getting on top of the evils which it faces. It's not someone else from the outside who's going to give you a kind of leg up and then get out of here and then leave you again to kind of face the same problems. It's going to be a member of the family itself. And we'll talk about shortly why then it's referred to as a wedding feast. And so Pope Francis goes on and paints this really extensive picture of, you might say, the nitty-gritty of Scripture, okay? One of the very interesting things is that in our Scriptures, there's this tension between the chosen people, and then you turn the page and you see how these people are epically failing in all kinds of ways. And that's something actually unique to Jewish and Christian Scriptures. There isn't this attempt to kind of gloss over the problems. In fact, in many ways, the problems are highlighted to demonstrate that it is not because of them that God has chosen them. You know, these are not extraordinary, superhuman people. That's why they're favored by God. Rather, it's His favor which precedes their merits or good works, and which is actually working in spite of their sufferings and failings. Now, this is going to be very important when we start to think of our own family situations this morning and especially tonight with Peter. This idea of God's grace preceding the things we think we can do to earn it. And so we see here Cain and Abel we've spoken about. Can anyone tell us a story from the families of Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob? It's chock full. Many of them absolutely scandalous, you know, to your typical person opening up the Bible for a bit of edifying reading. Can anyone think of anything? Tell us something about it, Simon.
So, because Abraham's wife Sarah was barren, she and Abraham was destined to have a son.
He was told, yep, they were the promise, yep.
Yeah, Sarah told him to sleep with their servant woman, Hagar, and he does, and then she has a son named Ishmael.
Yeah.
And then he just throws him out.
Man, that's right, they get the boot. And now, interestingly enough, who traditionally are seen as the children of Ishmael? Yeah. In other words, Scripture is always tracing back national conflicts to family conflicts. Okay, what it's trying to demonstrate is that the one human family, this is all internal conflict and fighting. In a sense, the reason we can hate each other so much is because we're so much like each other. No one can have it out like siblings and family. You know, and part of it is because you can't really ever get rid of them. You know, it's always there. You know, if you think about every time Easter rolls around, Christmas, weddings, funerals, every time you got to explain to someone who you are, oh, you're so-and-so's brother. You just can't ever shake it off. You know, and that's the point of these, that these are in-house fights, right? This is the nature of sin, is that we don't recognize ourselves as part of one family. We're kind of repeating the mistake of Adam and Eve's sin by saying, thanks but no thanks, we're going to go on our own from here. We'll be better off without you. The tragedies and violence marking the family of David. Now, it was typical in this time for the kings to fight with their armies. Okay. Does anyone know why there was some wisdom in having kings go out and fight with their armies? That's right. And also as well, it kind of gets your motives in place, you know. It's very easy to say, you know, it'd be really great to have that land over there. Send Johnny over there. But if you've got to go over, you're like, do we really need that land? Yeah, maybe not. So there was, you know, can you imagine kind of George Bush flying over there with his, you know, to fight on the front lines in the Middle East? No way. So it kept them honest. Now, straight away, because King David had stayed back at home while the armies are fighting, something unusual has taken place. In other words, he's already had a change of heart, so to speak. And of course, one of the great dangers we all face in our life is having too much time on our hands. That can get you into the most trouble. You know, boredom is the most dangerous thing on the face of the earth. It's a particularly modern problem as well. It's a first world problem, boredom. Did you know that the ancient Greeks didn't have a word for boredom? It's universally possible, but it's an unusual situation where you've got people lying around just not having to do anything and not wanting to do anything. It's a real kind of hollowing out of the human person. Anyway, so David's there and he's gone for a walk on the top, looks down into the neighbor's yard, and he sees Bathsheba getting a bit of sun on the roof.
Bathing.
Yeah. It was for clean purposes that she was naked on the roof. Anyway, so David invites her over, and you know, you get an invitation to the king's palace. You're gonna say no to the king? You know, so she goes over and one thing leads to another. They sleep together, she falls pregnant. Now the question then is, how can you explain her being pregnant when her husband is out fighting in a war? you meant the worst part. You meant the worst part, yeah, or the best part.
David tells her, go sleep with your husband, but her husband refuses to sleep with her. I will not sleep with you while my men are.
That's right. That's fighting. Yeah, yeah.
And they are like, they could be killed. So that's the worst part.
Yeah, he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't kind of indulge in luxury knowing his own men are out there spilling their blood on the ground. All right. Now, the reason I'm mentioning all this is because every time you think, oh my gosh, something has happened in our family which has never happened before, which is so irredeemably terrible that we are now cut off, you've just got to open up the Bible and then you'll realize this has been going on. You know, this has been going on. You know, so Pope Francis is setting a context for all of the problems which we think we face on our own. Okay, because remember, the very nature of sin is it isolates people. And so the most dangerous thing you can ever think is, I'm on my own here. Once you think that, you've already forgotten you are part of a family. Okay. Family and I'm in this on my own are two completely incompatible thoughts. It's worth mentioning as well here that we've spoken a lot about, I guess, voluntary evil or sin. But if we look at the situation of Job, what does Job's story bring to the table which the others don't quite? What was Job's family problems?
Actually, I was just going to say he brings patience and perseverance.
Yeah, in terms of how he faced these afterwards.
Death.
Innocence,
being a victim and the tragedy of that, because he didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah, that's true. So there's this sense of why is this happening? You know, if you think of the question the disciples asked Jesus at the start of John chapter 9, they see a man born blind and they turn to Jesus and they say, you know, Jesus, we've basically got the rest of the details figured out, but there's just one question. Did this person sin or did their parents sin? You know, because they were born blind, so obviously someone sinned. Was it him or his parents? You know, did God know he was going to do this crazy sin later on and so make him blind now? Were his parents, you know, swearing or something while he was in the womb and so he was born blind? You know, it's in other words, Jesus doesn't get caught up in the blame game. Whose fault is this? Rather, he's saying that now that this is the case, now that this is the facts, we can't change the facts, now that this is what it is, let's think about now how the glory of God is going to be revealed because of what comes about. Job's situation, similar to blindness, is, you might say, natural disasters, the idea of natural evil, the idea of losing your family and not having anyone clearly to blame, not being able to say, this is your fault. You know, and of course, when we can't clearly point at some human figure to blame, the finger kind of starts angling up so that God is the problem. Job's wife famously is getting very upset that Job is still faithful and says, why don't you just curse God and die? You know, his faith was really rubbing her up the wrong way, because you might say it was upsetting her conscience that he wasn't kind of drawing the same conclusions that she was. The principle which I want us to take away from this, though, moving forward, is that through each time, although we see human fallenness, God is staying faithful to his covenant. Okay? Now, there are a few things about covenant that we have to really be aware of, because in a sense, if marriage is the heart of the family and covenant is at the heart of what marriage is, we can't really understand what it means to be family if we don't understand what covenant is. Okay, these people are still famous, not because to the scandal of 21st century secularists looking to bag out the Bible, they're not morally perfect, but because of something God did for them, establishing a covenant. Why do we call marriage a covenant? It's not just an exchange of goods and services. Okay, so you'll notice that God is never getting involved in people's lives to say, hey, you know, you look really hungry, I'll give you some food if you're nice, you know. Or God doesn't say, you know, as long as you do this, then I'll do this for you, you know. Sometimes there are material rewards which come with it, but that's not the nature of it. As soon as Israel or the church start focusing on those things, then in a sense, almost indefinitely, they lose them. You know? To give you an example, it's kind of like you might have a great sense of peacefulness when you go to Mass, right? And St. John of the Cross would say that these are part of the gifts which God gives us early on when we're coming back to our faith, because it's easy, it's noticeable. You know you feel more peaceful when you do this. Keep doing it. You know, kind of like when you give lollies to kids when they do the right thing. You know, instead of giving them this whole treatise on the nature of love of neighbor, you know, give them a minty. And basically the minty is doing something very obvious, and that is rewarding them for doing something which is good in itself. But the moment they start doing it because they get a minty, that's when you've got to start holding back the minty. You see, now, God's relationship with us is a very similar point, that entering into relationship with God, entering into marital covenants, there are side effects which are very nice, which come with having these kinds of things, but the moment you think it's about that, you miss the point. And like Simon said, the nature of the covenant is not an exchange of goods and services, it's an exchange of the persons themselves. You know, that's why, for example, say you're going to a wedding next week or last week, you know, you don't rock up and then, you know, it comes time for the vows and the person says, okay, I promise to cook dinner on Friday night. If you drive the kids on Saturday morning, we'll have sex on Tuesday night. If you drive... Okay, I'm sorry, did you say you're going to drive or I'm going to drive? Okay, you're going to drive. It's not like that at all. In other words, it's not if you do this, I'll do that. It's through sickness and in health, for better or worse, till death do us part. In other words, this is my very self that I'm giving. I'm no longer my own. It goes deeper than all of these things. Okay, now why then, what does it mean for God to be establishing covenants with humanity? What's he promising them? Himself. And he's saying, I've got nothing better to give you. There's nothing better to receive than me. Once you think I'm only good for getting rain or something like that, you've missed the point. Okay. Now, we had a very big problem upholding our end of the covenants, obviously. And so hence, there was always this, you might say, looking forward to a future covenant where humanity would uphold our end of the bargain. You know, kind of like this realization that God in his faithfulness, something else has to happen for us to be able to echo back that faithfulness. Okay, and this is where we see God becoming a member of our family in Jesus. I won't read out our passage here, but you can see that Pope Francis basically shows how so much of Jesus' ministry evolved around families. There's even more which he mentions later, but it's very easy to see it's not actually until we're aware of it that so much of what Jesus did was working with families. Okay, now why is this the case? Well, because like I said, no benefit to humanity comes unless it comes through the family. This is why Matthew and Luke start their Gospels going through the genealogy of Christ. You know, that part of the Gospel when you're reading it and you think it feels like we're getting stoned to death by popcorns, you know, so-and-so was the son of so-and-so and so-and-so was the son of so-and-so. And we're like, you know, all this useless detail, why would you go to all the trouble? But what are Matthew and Luke trying to demonstrate here? That this is a member of the family. You know, kind of like when you rock up to some big leb function and, you know, your mum says, that's your cousin. And you're like, who? You know, that's so-and-so's son. Now, his sister married so-and-so. And what they're trying to do is generate this realization that you are not strangers to them. Okay, so Matthew and Luke trace back the genealogy. Luke goes all the way back to son of Adam, and Matthew goes back to son of Abraham. And what's the point they're trying to demonstrate? This is a member of our family. And in that genealogy, there's non-Jews, there's prostitutes, there's people who got into all kinds of shifty business. Now, in pagan culture, if that kind of shifty business was in your heritage, you're done. If you're the son of a so-and-so, you're done. There's no hope for you. So why is Matthew and Luke including all of the shameful aspects in Jesus' lineage? Because he's taking it all on. He's becoming a part of the family. Okay. So I've got here some examples. And again, it's not obvious until it's pointed out to us really how much in Jesus' own family life and situation he went through or experienced things which we just don't associate with the Holy Family. You know, things which we would take as signs of being abandoned by God or forgotten by God. Okay. It's interesting to think, you know, if we were going to choose any human life to live, what kind of life would you want to live? You know, now, if someone said, well, I want to live a life like this, you'd think, you're nuts. Why would you want to do that? You know, who would voluntarily sign up to a situation where you're going to lose one of your parents when you're young, that you're going to be misunderstood by people? No one would do that. Jesus does it. Why? Because he's trying to basically get people to see that none of these things isolate us from the love of God. Don't take any of these things as reasons for thinking, I'm done for now. If Jesus went through it and he is sinless, then we can go through it. Okay. I think this is actually a key part of what Pope Francis is trying to do that, again, can very easily be misunderstood because it would be crazy for someone to think, well, Jesus, for example, was 30 single and living at home with his parents. Therefore, all of us should be 30 single living at home with your parents. You know, that would be taking a kind of imitation of Christ's life in the wrong way. You know, it would be thinking, for example, you know, what did Jesus wear? We should be wearing that. It's not quite the kind of imitation we're called to. So Pope Francis here says that the covenant is renewed in Christ, that the fulfillment of covenant itself is in Christ's relationship to the church. Okay. Another way we could phrase it is that Jesus becomes part of our family so we can become part of his. Okay. Now, you might think, well, this sounds very abstract, but it's very real. Okay. Think about this, for example. Say you have a situation where a family is extremely poor, okay, and you've got another family who are very well off. And one of the children from the well-off family marry one of the children from the poor family. Now, you can see here that when that marriage takes place, it's not just, oh, the rich family are going to give us a bit of money. It's something more than that, because when that person married, they actually drew the rest of that family into theirs. You know, it's like the classic ways, for example, peace treaties used to be made in pre-modern times. The most effective way to do it was to have a marriage. You know, so if you want to make sure that France and Italy aren't going to go to war with each other, the French prince would marry an Italian princess, for example. And the idea is that they themselves are signs or sacraments of the political union between the two parties, okay? Now, we might think, oh, that's all good. You know, you've got an exchange of promises and whatnot. But like we saw in the Old Testament covenants, one of those parties could always renege. One of them could always say, sorry, you stuffed up. I'm getting out of here. And it wouldn't be right, but they could physically leave. You could physically go to war again. But what about when there is a child in that marriage? Can you divide up the child? You know, can you say, I'm taking half of our child? You know, is the child 50% French and 50% Italian so that, you know, we're taking the 50% of our French child back? That child is fully Italian and fully French. No one can say anything about Italians without talking about that child. Jesus is like that in terms of humanity and God. He's the child of the covenant, son of Adam and son of God. So that from that point on, you might say there is an irrevocable family bond which is made, which can never be undone. This gets particularly extraordinary when we think of something St. Paul says at the end of his letter to the Ephesians, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Where's that quote from?
Genesis.
Excellent. In other words, St. Paul's taking something which was said in the creation story. This mystery is a profound one, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. Now, here is an interesting point. What he's saying here is that this phrase primarily applies to Christ and the church, and our marriages are signs of that. It's not the other way around. The moment you think that Christ's relationship to the church is the sign and our marriages are the reality, we've got reality flipped upside down. What he's saying here is that in the story about Adam and Eve, a lot of different narratives are being woven in so that they apply. So that Jesus is really the one who leaves his father, leaves his homeland to be united to his bride humanity, and they become one flesh. Okay. Now, we often hear the church referred to as the bride of Christ, right? Where did Adam's bride come from? His side. You know, people are reading, thinking, you know, why his rib? And there's lots of different explanations for this, and they're all good, right? But then you've got this interesting situation where Jesus is hanging on the cross and his side gets pierced and water and blood come out from his side. And St. John in his gospel basically starts, for lack of a better word, freaking out, saying, I saw this with my own eyes. This is the person who saw this. Why making such a big deal of, I saw it come out of his side? What does that water and blood symbolize? Baptism and the Eucharist. In other words, this is one of the births of the church. So that Christ's bride, the church, is coming from his side. Right? So St. Paul is basically looking back at the Genesis account and realizing that the author is basically describing two stories, the story of Christ and the story of Adam, but it's primarily referring to the story of Christ. So it's a profound consideration. My second last point. Pope Francis basically says here that all the good intentions that we can have are not enough. All right, now, this comes as a shock to many people that good intentions are not enough. The basic principle of this is you can't give what you don't have. There are plenty of people right now who are trying to do something good and butchering it, or trying to do something good but haven't thought through really what needed to be done. Okay. So there's this basic principle that we ourselves need to be transformed and need to experience God's grace before we can be a channel of it. Okay. The moment we try and be a channel for God's grace and don't have it ourselves, people see through it straight away. Okay. People see, they see a double-sidedness or a hypocrisy, and it doesn't sit well, right? But when we've been forming ourselves properly, we actually don't have to do all that much for people to think there's something different about this. You know, all it can take is the way you look at someone, the small words you say, and it touches people's hearts. There's something authentic about it. So Pope Francis here is saying that when we're talking about family problems, the first thing we need to think of is before, what can I do to solve this situation? Is, well, what can I do to solve my problems? You know, now, we might think, well, that's being selfish. And if you wait until you're perfect, you never do anything. And it is possible that those become true in my situation. But generally speaking, when we receive that call from Christ to draw closer to him, that becomes an absolute priority. Okay? So Jesus says things like, you know, he holds up the commandments, honor your father and honor your mother. But then when he calls someone to follow him and the person says, oh, Lord, you know, my father just died. Let me just go and bury my dad and I'll come back. What does he say? Let the dead bury the dead. You know, and someone can say, well, Jesus, that's a bit anti-family, you know. He says things like, unless you hate mother and father, you're not worthy of me. These are very, very strong words. And they can be taken to be anti-family, as if someone has no responsibility to their family if they're following Christ. Rather, what he's trying to do, if we keep it all of what he said together, he's saying that if you don't come closer to him, how can you help your family? In other words, it's right at those moments where you might feel like, if I don't do this, I lose them, that sometimes we find ourselves in a way in which we can return to help them. To wrap up what we've been talking about, to link it back to one of our themes, you don't have to get in a car or a plane to discover where your Calcutta is. You don't have to get a degree to find it. You don't have to get paid to make a difference there. We are all born into a Calcutta. It's our family. It's our first Calcutta, you might say. And maybe even the last one, after we've gone off and done other aspects of our mission, it could be the one that really we come back to in the long run. So some things which we could discuss now or later, but things which I want you to keep in mind. The first one is to try and think of something concrete which you can do this week to reach out or begin a process of healing or to reignite something with a member of your family, okay? Now, you might think, well, I don't know what to do, you know, and it's always hard when you try and think of what, you know, I don't know what to do. A first place to begin is, well, what would I like someone to do for me? Now, that's not the be-all and end-all, but it's a starting point. You know, don't think, well, I would like someone to take me bowling. You know, I'm taking you bowling. It's not quite as simple as that. But think about the things which we would like that person to do for us and ask yourself, is there an equivalent which they enjoy doing? A second point, and this might be something for later on in the weekend. I know that you had adoration last night. So if it's not on again, it could just be a moment of prayer. A very effective thing you can do is to write down a little note for someone. It doesn't have to be profound like Shakespeare stuff. In fact, you'll find that the more kind of problems there are with the grammar and spelling and language, it even has its own way of even being more appreciated by family in ways which it is not appreciated by university lecturers, you know. I don't think it's cute when you misspell soup and say S-O-O-P, but maybe your mum will. I don't know. But the point is don't let any of these things be obstacles, right? Write down a little note and while you're praying, kind of ask God to shed some light on what's the truth of my relationship with this person, okay? And then you might find that, you know, you're inclined or you're inspired to put down one of these explanations, okay? And the reason it's good to write it down to give to them is because we all know that a change of atmosphere brings about a greater change within us. So the great change is, you know, you have this great experience on retreat, you think this is fantastic, and then you get home and someone's going, ah, and you think, okay, well, that's all gone, you know. But the piece of paper will not disappear, right? It's kind of defying our change of mind, you know. So what I would do as a third point is ask for the grace that when you get home that you won't chicken out and think, what was I thinking? That was stupid. And go to the neighbor's bin and throw it out in the neighbor's bin after you've snipped it into like 40,000 different scissor pieces. And you can just leave it somewhere where they'll find it, okay? Now, I think if we can do that, then maybe we just might be getting to the point which Pope Francis is trying to make in this new exhortation. It's a cliche, Rome wasn't built in a day, but it's worthwhile remembering that the smallest things can result in a change of direction, you know. If you think about when you're driving, it might not make a big difference if you turn the steering wheel a couple of millimetres to the right, but if you keep going in that direction, it's going to end up making a big difference. So sometimes you might think, well, this situation's so complicated and messy, what's something like that going to actually do to solve it? But if it's going to turn the steering wheel just slightly, even unrecognizably, over time, it could make a big difference. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for your patience.
That was Christian Stevens with the joys and struggles of family life. This presentation was part of the Finding Your Calcutta 2016 retreat, organized by St. Rafki Youth. And for more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.